This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the early 80s, the jangly guitars and mumbled lyrics of the band R.E.M. gained a devoted following among the alternative rock crowd. Stories about the old church where the band lived together and played in Athens, Georgia, were legend. As the band became more and more popular and eventually signed to a major label, they continued to be known for maneuvering their way through the record industry while holding on to their integrity. And they've endured for nearly three decades. Last year, REM was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now they have their first CD in 4 years, and it's really good. My guests are REM's lead singer, Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills. Let's start with the title track of REM's new CD, Accelerate. Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, Mike Mills, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you.
I really like that song a lot. It's one of my favorites on the CD. Would you like to say anything about writing it before we go any further?
It's one of those nightmare songs where you're falling without being able to stop, and it's one of those falling nightmare songs. That's where it came from.
Now, the new CD has 11 songs, and it's about 34, 35 minutes long, which is really short for a CD, but it works for me. I mean, I prefer listening to CDs than listening to just songs, you know, by different artists collected and scrambled together. But I often don't have enough time to make it through a whole CD in one sitting. So this is a kind of very, very nice amount to handle in one sitting. Why did you want to keep it that short? Because it is short for a CD.
Well, you know, when it was vinyl that was the medium, the physical content size of the piece of plastic meant that you had to clock in at 40 minutes or less, or you would overload the grooves and you would lose any sort of sonic quality. And then when they came out with CDs, people went, oh, my God, I can put an hour and 20 minutes of music on this thing. And unfortunately, a lot of people did, including us. So we just realized that it was, you know, it might be a good idea at this point in our career to rein it in a little bit and see. It's a lot of fun to say what you have to say in a really short amount of time. And if you can do that, and if you can really get a message across and pack it with a pretty powerful punch in less than 3 minutes or less than 3.5 minutes, then it's quite an accomplishment.
So it was a good songwriting exercise for you.
Yes, yes.
This is Michael. I think through the history of recorded music or pop music, certainly, either albums or singles have been kind of the focus. And it felt at one point recently that albums were kind of an old-fashioned way of approaching recorded music. But it's something that we as a band, I think, have always kind of strived towards is thinking more about an album as a collection of songs, possibly with the thread that kind of carries through the album. And it kind of feels now, you know, now that vinyl is back, it kind of feels like the album is, or thinking about the album like that is something a little bit prescient, that we've moved away now from singles and people listening to an album by an artist that they admire.
Do you see your new CD, Accelerate, as having a thread or a mood that holds it together?
I think it does, but then my contribution to what we do is writing the lyrics, and Peter and Mike's contribution to that is to telling me when they're really bad and that I need to edit them. But yeah, I think there's thematic threads.
Which would
running
be
through it. One of the big ones, I think, is me looking at the 21st century from 1973 when I was 13 years old, and I was in an environmental science course that was a year-long course. It was one of my 7 classes that I had in, I think, 7th grade. And the 21st century just felt like a place where, you know, at the time it felt like, wow, it's so far away, and we're gonna have renewable energy sources, and we're gonna take care of the pollution problem, and we're all gonna address, you know, the issues that need to be addressed, and we're gonna be a progressive society, well on its way to some not utopia, but something resembling the 21st century and the future. And, you know, sadly, 35 years later, that's not really what's happened.
You started playing together like 28 years ago. How have your motivations for playing and writing changed over the years? I mean, when you start off, you're like, you know, you're frustrated young people who like, you want to make music, you want to be well-known, you want money, you've got all of that. So how have your motivations changed?
Our motivation for writing music when we started was actually pretty much the same as it is now. We weren't doing it to make money or be famous or any of those things. We did it because that's pretty much all we were good at. And and it felt good to do it. You know, it's an itch that you have to scratch. And I still feel the same way. To me, one of the greatest things about being in this band is the excitement and the discovery of a new song, coming up with something that actually is still exciting. From whatever well is within us, that it comes out and it's like, wow, this is really great. We can still do that. And that's pretty much all the motivation you need.
Well, let me play a song from the new CD that I think is a new song that's exciting. And it's called Houston, and it's sung from the point of view of someone after Hurricane Katrina. And, Mike, I want to ask you about the organ or synthesizer that you're playing on this. It's so dark and so ominous. I really like the sound of it. I have no idea what you're doing.
Like, well, that makes two of us. It's actually what happened was I wandered into the studio, and Peter and Scott McCoy were playing that song on guitars, and I didn't know it. I'd never heard it before. So I just sat down and started playing what came to mind, and that's pretty much what's on the record. I didn't know what Michael was going to write about lyrically, but I felt the darkness of the song, and I wanted a really angry keyboard sound. I didn't know why, but I did. And then, so it's basically just a nasty farfisa run through a big old rat pedal. And then on top of that, we've got some more of the darkness and anger of that song. It exists in the bass. The idea of Scott McCoy came up with the idea. It's a bass through a really nasty fuzz pedal, doubled with a bowed upright bass, also through some nasty fuzz, and you know, we just knew it was a big, ugly, kind of scary sound. And then after Michael put the lyrics on it, we realized, oh my God, it sounds like a hurricane going by. Which, you know, we're never quite that literal, you know, with the music and the lyrics combining, but it happened that way, and it's just an excellent combination.
I think it's one of those cases where the music, the original music, inspired me to write that lyric, and then you guys having heard that lyric, you took that original music and made it
even more so.
Mm-hmm. And it is a very ominous musical landscape.
Peter, do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Well, yeah, Michael said he wanted songs that were a minute and a half long. So when I wrote it, I had a clock, and I just looked at the minute hand, and after a minute and a half, I was done. We just put as much stuff on there as we could. So it's not always about the forethought, you know. Sometimes it just occurs, and it just got uglier and weirder. I have noticed that the more cinematic something is when you give it to Michael, the more it'll catch his ear. So, you know, I think everyone's trying to bend it and shape it into some strange way.
Yeah.
So why don't we hear Houston? This is from REM's new album, Accelerate. Houston is filled with promise.
Laredo's a beautiful place. And Galveston sings like that song that I love. Its meaning has not been erased. And so there are claims forgiven.
That's Houston from REM's new CD, Accelerate, and my guests are Michael Stipe, the vocalist, Peter Buck, guitarist, Mike Mills, who plays bass and keyboards. And Mike, was there any synthesizer on that too, or was that just pure organ?
No, it's all analog. It's just an old Farfisa with some nasty pedals.
So do they still make Farfisas, or is that an old organ?
I don't know that they do, but we keep an eye out for them, and we've got one or two lying around because they're, you know, they have a very, very distinct sound, and when that's what you want, that's what you have to have.
Let's go back to when you all met in Athens, Georgia, and this would be about what year?
About 1979.
Okay. Can you each describe something about how you knew you could play with the others, that this would work, that you were compatible musically?
Well, when we first got together in the old abandoned church, I remember it was freezing. That's all I remember. It was really, really cold. Bill Berry and I had played together in bands in Macon, Georgia, and we had a couple of songs that we'd written back then, and we showed them to Peter and Michael, and I remember just loving what they both did with the songs. Peter played guitar in a way that I'd never really heard anyone play before, and even then Michael had a really great grasp on how to sing, and it was very different from how I would have done it, which is what I was looking for. So I just remember thinking, you know, I can do stuff with these guys.
What was different about Peter's guitar playing than what you'd heard before?
Peter...
More inept.
The finest ineptitude ever heard by man. Peter plays with an arpeggiated style. He has, I love saying this phrase, he has the best right hand in the business. But instead of just thrashing away and strumming chords, which, you know, what everyone does, and it all tends to sound the same, you can really create melody after melody after melody by arpeggiating with the right hand, which is what Peter does, and it just opens up all this space for me to noodle around on the bass, and it just hadn't, I hadn't really heard it that much at that point.
Peter, how did you start playing that way?
You know, I remember really liking the Byrds, the band The Byrds, when I was learning to play guitar, and I was so ignorant about music that not realizing that Roger was finger picking and using four fingers, I just worked really hard to imitate him using a flat pick. And by the time I actually figured out that he was doing this kind of folk finger picking thing, I was kind of flat picking in a way that was a little different, and kind of, I don't know, it wasn't my own style necessarily, but it was at least a start.
And Peter, what made you realize that you wanted to play with the other members of REM who weren't yet REM?
Yeah, you know, it really was just the first rehearsal. I mean, within a day or two, we had 8 or 10 kind of original songs. I mean, as original as we were writing at that time anyway. And they sounded good, you know. We got better as songwriters, but it seemed to fit together really well immediately, which, you know, is from what I've heard later from other people, doesn't usually happen. I mean, you don't usually get that kind of band experience in the first day or two.
And Michael?
I felt like we had to write 20 or 25 songs before we really knew what we were doing, because none of us were that proficient on our instruments. Mike and Bill probably more so than Peter and I. When I started the band, it didn't occur to me that I would have to write lyrics. I kind of had this kind of teenage fantasy idea of what it was to be in a band and to be able to tour and what have you, and it didn't include the actual work. So it took me a while to come around to that.
The impression I got from the first time we spoke in the 90s is that when you started singing, you were just a little shy about it.
I was a little shy about everything. I think I was pathologically so.
Michael, you had said that in 1985 you felt that you started to come into your own and get more comfortable, you know, as a songwriter and performer. 2 years later, in 87, REM had its first real hit, The One I Love. And I'm wondering if you knew when you recorded this that this was somehow going to be different, if it felt musically like something happened that hadn't happened before.
I always said, and I think I probably stole this from Peter or Mike, I always said that I wouldn't know a hit single if it was sitting in my lap, and I feel like perhaps the producer that we were working with on that record had an idea that that song could make it onto the radio, or that our time had come to be a top 40 radio band. But I certainly didn't recognize that.
Yeah, it was my, I think, eighth favorite song on that record.
Really?
So it wasn't, you know, it was like, oh, yeah, we put it on side two. It was kind of, but, you know, that's fine. I mean, it wasn't, we didn't write it for any particular reason other than that we just wrote it and it popped up and then it was a kind of a hit. And, you know, I mean, hit singles are kind of meaningless in their way. I mean, it's just a song that you wrote that day.
I remember talking to, when we were making Document, there was something on Document that I really thought was a really great song. It might have been End of the World, I'm not even sure. Thinking, you know, okay, we've had a hit. Maybe this is another one. I remember asking Scott Litt, you know, when people are making these things, I was like, for example, when Petula Clark and her producers were making Downtown, did they know what they were doing? Did they know what a great song they had? He goes, yep. So, you know, sometimes people know and sometimes you don't.
One thing that sounds different to me in this era of the band is I think, Michael, your voice is more out front as opposed to more in the mix. And I guess I'm wondering how everybody felt about that.
Well, you know, that was fine. When we did the first record, I had a kind of picture in my head that, you know, it would be, wow, this weird kind of, you know, like some record from the 60s that you just can't figure out what the context was. It's just kind of this beautiful artifact. And, you know, we weren't really guaranteed that we were going to get to do five records or 14 or whatever. I mean, I was kind of thinking, well, we'll get this record and maybe if we're really lucky, we'll get another one. And you know, Murmur, that first record, that was kind of what I thought it should be. It's kind of like a radio beacon from some other planet, you know. And then it was like, gee, we sold a few of those. We get to make another and another after that. And, you know, that kind of tends to focus you in a different way. I mean, certainly if we thought, you know, radio airplay was important, Murmur wouldn't sound like it does. But I think if we had thought radio airplay was important, we would have made a not very good record.
Well, why don't we hear The One I Love from 1987? Since we had been talking about that. And this is R.E.M., and my guests are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my out to the one I love. Fire! Fire! This one goes out to the one I love.
That's R.E.M. from 1987, and my guests are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills of R.E.M. They have a new CD, which is called Accelerate. That song led to a recording contract with Warner Brothers. How did it change your lives to be with a major label? Let's start with how did it change your music? Did the label obviously was going to provide money, more money than you had before, to make an album, which opens up new opportunities. What opportunities did the recording contract open, and were there also suggestions of things the label wanted that you didn't necessarily want?
We always had a great relationship with Warner Brothers. I mean, they knew what they were getting when they signed us. We made it clear when we signed with IRS and Warner Brothers following that we had complete creative control. We did what we want, when we wanted, how we wanted, and which is just so unbelievably rare in the music business. But nonetheless, that was our demand, and that's what we got.
How did it change your lives on the road to have like a major label behind you and the money for a tour? How did it change like how you got around, where you stayed, what your day to day life was like?
It was exactly the same.
Really that different?
Yeah,
it was,
really?
You know, I mean, you know, it wasn't as if we got the golden slipper and everything was great. I mean, we kind of, you know, we just went out and played some more.
We broke even or made money on every single tour we ever did from the very beginning.
Which is rare.
which is rare. But I mean, you see all these people screaming that they can't tour without corporate support and record company support. That's just not true. We broke even or made money every single time without any help from the record label. It was all, you know, we lived within our means and took the door from the places we played, and we lived in you know, one hotel room or one van or whatever it took. So it didn't. We didn't want it to alter anything. We didn't want to be in debt to anyone. We didn't want anyone to have any control over what we did. So we did whatever was necessary to maintain our freedom, and it worked out really well.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the band R.E.M. with its lead singer Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills. R.E.M. has its first CD in 4 years called Accelerate. When we left off, we were talking about the band's early history.
I want to jump ahead to 1991, to your recording Losing My Religion, and I think it's a perfect record. I mean, it's a great song, great singing, and I love the mandolin on it, and the strings. But Peter, let's start with the mandolin. Like, what made you think of a mandolin for this?
You know, I think I was on the 89 tour and I just bought a mandolin. I mean, it was just that simple. I had a day off in New York and found this kind of strange, you know, I'm not sure what, it wasn't an American mandolin. It was like Greek or something. And it just, you know, I mean, it was just something to do on the bus, you know, plunk around at the thing. And so I kind of wrote it on mandolin. It wasn't, I didn't have any great foresight, and I never really played mandolin that much. I mean, I think if you added up the amount of time I played mandolin in my life, it might be 50 hours, and 49 hours that would be playing Losing My Religion on stage. So it's not as if I've, you know, I didn't become an expert at it. It just became just one of those things I started using. And I guess I was hanging around with a bunch of folk musicians, and that kind of just entered my life a little bit.
And Michael, the phrase Losing My Religion, is that what came first to you lyrically? And how did it come to you as the title phrase of the song?
I don't remember writing the song at all. I remember singing it in the studio, but I don't remember writing it. But the phrase comes from, I actually changed it. The phrase is Lost My Religion. And it's a Southern phrase that indicates something that has pushed you so far that you question your faith.
It's kind of like the 20s version of Blowing My Mind.
Oh, okay, so I'm going to play it. This is R.E.M., Losing My Religion.
That's R.E.M., and my guests from R.E.M. are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills, and they have a new CD, which is called Accelerate. Do you guys still like the song?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, good. It's a beautiful song.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It doesn't get old. It's the one song I'd say we've probably played at basically every single show since we put the record out. And it's always fun to play. I mean, anything that makes that many people that happy, too, is a fun thing to do.
There was a period, skipping ahead just a few more years, in 1995 when nearly everyone in the band was sick. The drummer, then Bill Berry, collapsed on stage with a brain aneurysm. Peter, you had surgery for, I think, an intestinal adhesion.
That was Mike.
No, that was Mike.
I've never been sick. Yeah.
I'm still healthy.
Good.
I was looking,
good.
Peter was looking both ways before he crossed the road.
Yeah, I was definitely just going, well, you know.
and Michael, you had emergency surgery for a hernia. A couple of years after that, Bill left the band. And from what I've read, he said that he wasn't going to leave if it meant that the band would split up. And you decided to all stay together. Was that the only time you've come close to breaking up?
Now, you know, I think being in a band is an ongoing process, and I think that everyone at one point or another thinks, you know, I could just walk away from it. And it's kind of nice knowing that you can walk away from it. I can't imagine how resentful it would be if you just felt like, okay, I can never leave this band.
Yeah.
But the freedom to walk away means that you don't have to. You know, we're totally able to work and take some time off. You know, and it's still an option to walk away from it, but it isn't something that I want to do.
We've always given each other the freedom to do whatever we want outside the band, which is, you know, not a difficult thing to grant, and it's also helpful. I mean, you go out and you play with other people, you bring back certain inspirations and ideas that you might not have had within your little four walls, and it can be well to your advantage to do that.
How do you think your songwriting process changed when the drummer Bill Berry left the band in 97?
Basically, we didn't really know what to do, so we decided that it meant we could do anything we wanted. We took away a lot of the structure that we were using. We used a lot of drum machines as sort of a secondary element rather than as a primary element. We wrote a lot on keyboards, not just myself, all of us. Started just using any weirdo keyboard that we could find. We had an arsenal of these little strange things, most of which aren't made anymore. And we just decided to try to turn it to our advantage and say that all the rules are gone. There are no songwriting structure rules. We can do literally anything we want here. And, it just meant that, once again, we had no idea what we were doing. Which is in its own way kind of liberating, and we just took it as an opportunity to try to experiment and go in different places that we hadn't gone before.
Do you feel like with a new CD that it's just kind of clicking for you this time around, like this one?
I have to say I felt good about the records that we made, without Bill Berry to one degree or another. Some of them were more successful than others, but I'm pleased with all of them to some degree. At the same time, as has been repeated ad nauseum, you know, when Bill Berry left the band, the dynamic radically changed. Everything we knew no longer was something we could rely on. So we had to create a whole new reality. We had to create a whole new dynamic, a whole new way of working as a three-piece instead of a four-piece. And, you know, we weren't just missing one leg of the chair. We were missing Bill Berry, which was a huge thing. And it's taken us, I think we've gotten more and more comfortable as it's gone along. But I think that probably right now we're as comfortable with being a three piece as we've ever been,
yeah,
and feel good about it.
And I'll agree with Mike. I'm really proud of all the songs that we've written since his departure from the band. I will say that I think the album Up was a few songs too long. I think that the album Reveal was quite beautiful. It was an idea and a concept, and we took it as far as we possibly could to write an entire record that felt like. Felt like a summer, a lazy summer afternoon.
Beautiful.
And our last record, Around the Sun, has, I think, beautiful songs on it. We did lose some focus in the studio there on that record, and I think that the live versions of those songs are better than the recorded versions. And we have no one to blame but ourselves. I mean, the three of us were responsible for losing focus. And we had a tremendous producer working with us, Pat McCarthy, who had, I think, probably the most difficult job in the world, which was to try to bring the three of us to some kind of solution, song by song. But I'm really happy where the new record, where Accelerator, has brought us. We have a fine drummer in Bill Rieflin, who provides, I think, not only the kind of the kind of grounding that you need from a drummer, but also a kind of muscle to. To some of the vocals and to some of the ways that Peter plays guitar. And what we've done is we've kind of yet again reinvented ourselves, playing on our strengths, having gone through this kind of experimental phase where we did kind of throw out possibly the baby with the bathwater, but we then came back and kind of salvaged it.
I'd like to ask you each about your music background, which some of which is so like not the image of like the indie band performer. Like Mike, you were in marching band, which must have really been fun. I love marches.
Yeah, it was great fun. I played. I carried a sousaphone around for a year or two, and then we switched it over to electric bass for the high school football games. And I had somebody tote my bass out onto the field, and I stood there in a leisure suit and played electric bass while
I wish I'd seen the band.
You can see my high school yearbook sometime. It's got me in there.
And Peter, I read that your first live concert was seeing Jesus Christ Superstar in 1970. Is that right?
Yeah, with my mom. And the guy next to me handed me a joint. I was 12.
Did you take a toke?
You know, I just looked at it, and I looked at my mom, and I just kind of looked straight ahead. it wasn't really my thing. Actually, the first actual live performance I ever saw of music was when I was in second grade, and we lived in Richmond, California, which is near San Francisco. And it was like 1964 or 5, and this band came in, and I remember they did Turn, Turn, Turn and Help by the Beatles. They had a 12-string guitar. They came to our school and played at lunch hour. I have no idea why. And I just remember thinking, that's cool. And all the little girls got, you know, their arms autographed and stuff. It was all over for me then.
Michael, do you remember your first concert or your first, like this is really great music experience?
Well, my first great music experience, I think, is probably discovering punk rock when I was 15. And I went and bought the Patti Smith album, Horses, the day that it was released.
Were you,
and decided then and there that that's what I was going to do with my life, was sing in a band.
When you'd go to a club and hear punk rock, were you like a quiet, restrained listener, or did you, you know, like jump up and down and do the whole thing?
I jumped up and down and did the whole thing, but I also, my kind of like incredible geek moment, or one of them, is that I was supposed to be 21 years old, so I had a fake ID that said I was 24. I had really curly hair at the time and chest hair, which was really rare for a 16, 17-year-old. So I would wear my shirt unbuttoned down to my belly button to show the chest hair, because I thought that made me look older. And I would pick my hair out so that it looked like an afro, and I'd wear platform shoes. So I was at the punk rock show in platform shoes with a big afro and my shirt. Yeah. It was a little bit of a mixed message going on there.
Wow.
But I did see some – I saw some pretty good – well, I got in the club. I mean, that's the good news.
Right.
I did see some pretty amazing bands, and I took pictures of most of them with my camera, with my father's camera, actually, that I would always carry with me back then.
Michael, I don't know if you are interested in talking about this at all or not, but people were for so long interested in knowing, like, what's his sexual orientation? Is he gay? Is he straight? Is he bi?
Right.
And then in 2001, in an interview with Time magazine, you said I'll just quote the article. It said, in the past, Stipe avoided questions about his sexuality, but now he's more comfortable discussing it. Quote, I was being made to be a coward about it rather than someone who felt like it was really a very private thing, unquote. He now readily describes himself as a, quote, queer artist, unquote.
Right.
What changed for you in 2001 that – well, let me back up and say
– What changed is I was misquoted in Time magazine.
Oh. Oh.
And I really like the journalist, so it's not against him. But when I said I was being made to be a coward, I was referring to the early 90s, not to 2001. And, in fact, with the band, with my friends and family, I was always very open about my sexuality. But I felt like it was, for me, it was a privacy issue as a public figure. And I felt like I gave away enough of myself as a singer and as a public figure. But I did feel in the early 90s with ACT UP and with everything that was going on with AIDS, a lot of pressure to speak openly about my sexuality. And so I did. I think the first real interview that I did where I spoke openly was in 1994. And then I was on the cover of Out magazine, and we put out the Monster album, which was, you know, a very kind of overtly sexual record. And I talked about a lot of stuff then. So I was kind of misquoted in the Time magazine thing, or it wasn't quite. They edited it down a little bit too much there.
Uh-huh. Is it the kind of thing that you talk to the band about? I don't mean your sexuality. I mean about whether to talk about it publicly or not.
No, it never seemed like that big a deal to me because it felt, I don't know. I always never know how to talk about this. I always felt like sexuality was something that was kind of divided into some very kind of black and white camps. And to me, and to a lot of people in my life, in fact, it's more of a fluid thing than that. And so I would not describe myself as either homosexual or bisexual, because that is, I think, a little bit limiting, certainly not heterosexual. But I do think that, there's an idea that people are a percentage kind of one way or a percentage another way. And some people are 100% homosexual. Some people are 100% heterosexual. Some people like myself might be 70-30 or something like that. And I always never kind of – I thought, well, that's kind of limiting too. But the truth is that's kind of probably what it is.
Like 70 gay, 30, not, 30 hetero?
Or, yeah. I would say I'm attracted to 3 women to every 7 men, something like that. I'm in a 10-year relationship with a man who I'm madly in love with. And it was really it was trying to honor the relationships before this one because there was love, but I was not in love. And so there was a way of not talking about those relationships was somehow honoring them.
I want to end with another track from the new CD, and I thought we'd play Sing for the Submarine, and I'll ask you to talk about writing it.
I remember the music part of it. I was sitting backstage at some show in Italy, and I was playing this kind of ridiculously convoluted guitar line, and Michael walked by and stuck his head in and said, that's pretty good. Do you have a chorus? So, yeah, here's the chorus. He goes, good, remember that. So I said, okay, I'll remember that. And, you know, it wasn't – I was actually just doing it to warm up my fingers because it's kind of complicated. That said, I didn't really see how there would be anything that Michael would find there to work with.
And I had to dig deep for that one. God knows. But in that song, it's about a submarine that's fueled by melody, and it takes place in an imagined future. And it's really about a guy who's figured out a way to escape from a city that's under siege or collapsing by going to the shore with his loved one and singing and escaping to safety in the melody-fueled submarine. Yeah.
No. which actually means it's about the power of the subconscious. So
is that what it is?
Yep.
Okay, thank you, Peter, because I didn't know. I mean, God knows we already have a pretty good submarine song in the pop canon that we didn't need another one. But the song references a lot of other songs going back through our 28 years of writing. And each of those songs, including this one, are songs that come from my dream world, which takes place since I was a young, as long as I can remember. My dreams are set in a post-apocalyptic future where everything's kind of torn down and put back together again and held up with 2x4s and kind of scotch taped together.
Much like the world we live in now.
Yeah. How old were you when you started having those post-apocalyptic dreams?
Well, as long as I've dreamt. I don't know. I had scarlet fever when I was a kid, so maybe that kicked it off. But as long as I can remember, my dreams were somewhere between. And I know other people have these dreams because I look at pop culture, I look at film, I look at literature and drawings and paintings, and other people live in that same world, I think, in their dream world. But, it's somewhere between Children of Men and Blade Runner, but it's a little bit happier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's been great to talk with you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For talking with us. And good, not that you need it, but good luck with the new CD.
Terry, yes, thanks. Indeed. Thanks so much.
Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills of the band R.E.M. Their new CD is called Accelerate. You can hear R.E.M.'s complete performance at the recent South by Southwest Music Festival by going to our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Here's the song we were just talking about, Sing for the Submarine.
I tried to explain how it all begins, how it's all destroyed and built again. I knew that you could not believe me, but now you're here and it's different. How the light shines in your eyes, and every second of century. We know it.
The Taiwanese director Ang Lee has made several acclaimed films, from Sense and Sensibility and The Ice Storm to Brokeback Mountain, for which he won the Oscar for Best Director. But his most recent film, Lust, Caution, received a lukewarm response when it came out here last fall. The film has just come out on DVD, and our critic at large, John Power, says it tells a story about China that could hardly be more timely.
How you feel about a movie often depends on where you're coming from, sometimes literally. A good example of this is Lust, Caution, which was treated here as a sex-laced espionage thriller. Most American critics found the movie dull. Too much caution and not enough lust, one of them joked. But on a recent trip to Asia, I discovered that nearly everyone there thought it was great. Lust, Caution was a huge hit, making 15 times as much money abroad as it did in the U.S. Now the movie's out on DVD in two versions, the NC-17 original and a less steamy R-rated cut. And if you haven't seen it, I think you'll find that the Asian audiences were right. But keep one thing in mind. While Lust, Caution does boast racy sex scenes worthy of Last Tango in Paris, this is not an action-packed spy thriller. Instead, like another Bertolucci movie, The Conformist, it unfolds slowly, even dreamily. What it's actually about is the gradually shifting consciousness of its heroine, an ordinary young woman caught in the whirlpool of history. The story takes place in Hong Kong and Shanghai during the Japanese occupation of World War II. The heroine is Wang Jiajie, we'll call her Miss Wang, played by a newcomer named Tang Wei. Miss Wang is a shy, aspiring actress who gets recruited into a resistance plot to assassinate a big-shot collaborator named Mr. Yi. He's played by the great Hong Kong actor Tony Leung. Miss Wang pretends to be the wife of an out-of-town tycoon, luring Mr. Yi into an affair that will make this cautious man vulnerable to a hit team. She follows the plan perfectly. Normally rather plain-looking, Miss Wang flowers into a ravishing creature who not only lets herself be lured into bed, but throws herself into their lovemaking with utter abandon. In fact, she performs the role of Mr. Yi's lover with such conviction that she runs the risk of forgetting who she really is. It's a confusion of identity that threatens disaster. The question is, disaster for whom? Lust, Caution is based on a story by Eileen Chang, perhaps the most worldly Chinese fiction writer of the last century. I'd recommend her collection of stories from the 40s called Love in the Fallen City. Chang focused on characters, especially women, whose identities become unmoored because of their mercurial desires and because of society's rapidly changing values, modernity's head-on collision with Chinese tradition. Chang's heroines are forever playing roles that don't fit their real selves and are often quite illicit. All this role-playing makes Chang's work ideal for the Taiwanese-born director Ang Lee, a quiet, seemingly square man who is actually a sneaky radical. He's not a gaudy stylist like Bertolucci or Paul Thomas Anderson, nor is he an overt troublemaker like Michael Moore. But he constantly pushes the envelope of what's expected and accepted, whether it's bringing kung fu into the Western mainstream with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or making Brokeback Mountain, a matter-of-fact love story about two cowboys. In Lust, Caution, Lee pushes against two Chinese taboos. The obvious one is erotic. Lee clearly wants to open up sexual themes to Chinese audiences. But he also wants to expand political freedom by telling a story that challenges party mythology about the national history. All these years later, the government still wants to bury the fact that some Chinese, like Mr. Yi, collaborated with the Japanese. Of course, there's a risk to annoying party commissars, even in this year when China is using the Olympics to put on its best face. Just as the fictional Miss Wang gets into trouble by playing someone she isn't, so the real-life actress Tang Wei has gotten in trouble for playing Miss Wang. Charged with being lewd and politically incorrect, she's been banned by her government. The mainland will no longer show Tang's movies or commercials. She's a cosmetic spokeswoman. And the press has been told not to mention her name. All this shows yet again that the Chinese government is still often painfully, even ridiculously, repressive. But it's important to realize that the government isn't the whole story about China, which is changing even faster today than it was in Eileen Chang's time. The underlying truth is that people there liked Lust, Caution. They flocked to it in theaters and bought it on bootleg DVDs. One young idealist even tried to sue the government for trimming the sex scenes. While party apparatchiks may be on top for now, it's the people, including sneaky rebels like Ang Lee, who are actually leading China into the future.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.